It's Mark Larson, and our general topic is builders nature photography, but I thought I would give you some insights into the history of the role that art and photos played in the conservation of the West, and wilderness in particular first, and then we'll run through the slides. The slides are aimed primarily at teaching photography, and so if we have questions and topics, make sure you interrupt. The last two summers I've had a chance to teach a workshop called Conservation of Wilderness Through Art and Photography. And of course, with photography being 150 years old, 151 this year, we know pretty much the time span. But let's set the stage. We of course had a whole group of American colonists arrived, some voluntarily, some involuntarily, from the 1600s on, from the east, arriving on these shorelines, and of course the general impression was indeed wilderness, but not with this marvelous wilderness vision that we're lucky enough to have today. The colonists of that era viewed the wilderness. Imagine this trees, or the trees right behind your cabin up here, as a rather fearsome place. And indeed, it stayed that way for quite a while in terms of most people's minds. It was a place to be conquered, it was not a place to paint, it was not a place to write about for the most part, except in very dark and gloomy terms. But a marvelous transition occurred. It's called the Romanticist era, arrived, and painters started doing what to wilderness in their images? Is anybody familiar with the Romanticist paintings?
Impressions?
And, well, it, part of it. Turner, out of, in particular, they started painting light. If you look at the Romantic era, that's one of the most marvelous aspects of this transition. Instead of dark and gloom, we suddenly are seeing light. And of course, if you get up at 6:50 tomorrow morning or watch the 6:50 sunset, you will see the same light that Turner attempted to paint. I'm trying to arrange for a rainbow and lots of clouds tomorrow for our 2 p.m. hike, but I don't think there'll be any guarantees of that. The romantic type paintings also placed humans in the wilderness in rather pastoral settings. The pastoral meaning pleasant, the animals, the Native Americans. And probably the best example, I'm going to zip through this really quickly, one of the best examples in American history is Bierstadt, who also did what with wilderness? He transformed it from landscape, real landscape, to dreamscape. He changed reality and said, first of all, he's trying to make a living, right? He's painting for an audience. But he said, from a romantic view, and of course this is from the romantic poets and writers as well, reality isn't good enough. Let's change it. Let's shape it in a way that makes it even better. By the way, Bierstadt also used a camera in later on in his career. If you look at some of his paintings, they have enough realism in terms of shape and location. Painters, by the way, have this marvelous composition tool, which of course some of you are familiar with. You can move things around. And if you look at a lot of the famous paintings of Yosemite, or even in the East, the classic Split Rock or Niagara Falls, things don't look the way they actually look. And that's just an interesting tool that painters have. If we interrupt the flow of the Romantic era, there was also a fantastic movement into the West of painters, Bierstadt being one of them, but a painter by the name of Catlin did something for us today that is almost impossible to imagine today. Not long after the mountain men really were out here trapping and had ended their era, he came out as a tourist to paint Native American life. And you need to look at Catlin's work as if you were in a time machine. Because unlike the Romanticists, Catlin attempted to document reality. But he viewed these Native Americans from a romantic view in the sense that they were the pure type of native, untouched by civilization as he knew it and so on. So you need to look at it, his work in that way. But it's authentic. Unlike Curtis, who came along later in 1910 and started dressing the Native Americans up for his photographs, Catlin has an incredible story to tell in his painting. Quickly then, we make a fantastic transition in our life to one of the most horrific eras, and that is the Civil War, and of course the application of photography to documenting that Civil War. Two people came from the Civil War as photographers that I think names you need to remember. One is O'Sullivan, and O'Sullivan probably typifies what today we know as the stress syndrome type of personality as a result of his experiences in the Civil War. He was forced to endure some of the most horrific aspects, not as a army soldier, but as a photographer. He did some of his diaries and stories, of course, are just incredible about that era. And then Jackson, who to me typifies the true adventurer and photographer of the West. He never really saw a major battle in the Civil War, but spent almost 2 years as a soldier. But both of these men left that Civil War driven to the West, to see the West, and then to apply photography to what they saw. O'Sullivan and Jackson both managed to hook up with government surveys of the West. And here comes the first true story that of conservation of the West via photography, and of course paintings as well. But Jackson hooked up with the Hayden Survey that came up into the Yellowstone area from the south, because if you came from the east, you'd likely be dead from the Sioux. They really blocked the east routes. But they came up from the south up into Yellowstone, Jackson photographing along the way for the Hayden Surveys, 1870, 1872, and so on. And the railroads in particular, and a series of leaders said to Congress, let's set aside this special place. Let's not use it as a private development. Let's do something. Not a new idea necessarily in the West, but suddenly there was a new idea on the walls of Congress. Jackson's photographs. Another individual in California, of whom very little has been known until recently, when a friend of mine has recently published two books about him, Carlton Watkins, started photographing Yosemite in 1860 and did, through his photographs, exactly the same thing. Yosemite was actually the first set-aside park that was a state park. Yellowstone claims what? The first national park. And in both cases, I think we can attribute their preservation to photographs. The painters, of course, were equally successful in capturing a vision of those places as they made this transition from the romantic kind of views of things, the Bierstadt efforts, to more realistic paintings that what we would recognize today. But of course, it's difficult to crank out literally hundreds and thousands of images, which these photographers did. By way of introduction to the slides, which I know you want to get to, and myself too, perspective, a chance to see a place, is what photography did to America in the 1865 era on. If you look in through your grandparents' and great-grandparents' remnants of their lives, almost everybody has those stereo photographs, right? The two images that you stick in this stereopticon, and you slide back and forth for focus. This was what the first mass media reproduction device of using photographs, rather than just these very expensive images that would go up on a wall. And again, this is how people traveled, though, by staying at home, through those kinds of stereo images. And literally millions of those things were published as a popular mass media. Now, of course, I guess what the equivalent would be our slides and
videotape,
right, which is now the next step. Again, let me just quickly summarize. Our parks would not be here today. Our Western landscape would not be here today if it were not for these early painters and these early landscape photographers. And I encourage each of you to go to libraries, to places that you can find their work and look at it and ask yourself, what role did this play? And then as you look at, for example, a book on Ansel Adams that's coming out just this fall now, of course it costs $100, so you might want to go to the library, but it's a collection of his writings. He died in 1984 at 82. Active to the end, writing letters, giving speeches, taking photographs and donating photographs and donating his time and efforts to save what is left. I will end this introduction by saying perhaps that's too what our photography should be used as much as we can. I always like to use this slide by way of introduction. You can see the Baja Peninsula up there at the top. To remind ourselves that indeed this is a very fragile planet, and it wasn't until the astronauts were up there snapping away with their little cameras and bringing back these kinds of images that I think our attitudes changed enormously about our planet. Everybody knew, of course, that it was round. I also like to cite John Muir and his words, "I care to live only to entice people to look at nature." I always like to say that I think he would have made a marvelous photographer, except he was so busy keeping journals and marching through the wilderness of the Sierra Nevada and elsewhere, carrying only a blanket and some cornmeal. He wouldn't pack a telephoto lens with himself, too heavy. My favorite quote, though, "The winds will blow their freshness into you and the storms their energies, while cares will drop off you as autumn leaves." This is a well-known image of him in his home, Yosemite Park. John Muir is the fourth person from the right in the beard next to Teddy Roosevelt. He, again, played this incredibly instrumental role in saving Yosemite, but he did it by having a failure that in fact contributed enormously to his death, and that is the loss of Hetch Hetchy to a dam to supply water for San Francisco. Again, one of the most pivotal moments in our national history of conservation, a dam within a national park. Of course, we then had other battles. By the way, there's a favorite story also. Teddy Roosevelt, you know, this adventure type of person, slept under 32 blankets on Glacier Point that night and woke up covered by a couple inches of snow, finding himself enjoying the adventure a lot. This is at the Sequoia Big Trees area. I wonder where the women were in this particular. Yeah. Those of you, by the way, who have attended one or more of the sessions will, of course, see some redundancy in these slides. I hadn't really anticipated providing just a slideshow of my work, and I don't want to do that. Another facet of photography that I cited earlier that intrigues me is the ability to travel through time through images. Early settlers like this were visited by itinerant photographers, and they, of course, immediately, if you had a sod shanty, would pile all of your belongings out of the sod shanty into the front yard for the long exposure time that it took. This probably was a 5 to 10 second exposure, and you had to stand really still. In this case, they're very prideful of their produce that they produce.
It should be. Yeah. Looks pretty good.
Unfortunately, it probably was a farm in northern Wisconsin or Minnesota after the logs had all been cut off. But again, traveling through time, it's an amazing process photography allows us to do. 1966, the first environmental theme type photos started showing up, and of course newspapers and magazines running in color, documenting how we dump our sewage into our drinking water. It's a great saying. In China, they put the sewage on the fields. In America, we put it in our drinking water. But I again would argue that photographs of nature and of what we're doing in a negative sense really led to the environmental movement much more than almost any other medium. Now, quickly, we'll talk about all the things that a photographer needs as we go out. I would argue, however, that there's also a minimal approach to the strategically placed camera. The text I've used this last week is by this individual, John Shaw, and he's illustrating here the use of a tripod in his close-up photography, which carved his niche in the world of nature photography. He also illustrates the technique of allowing a mosquito to rest on your forehead during the exposure. Again, if this is a redundant, I apologize for those of you first to hear it. PhD cameras, the PhD light meter is the problem for your photography. You need to gain control of the light meter. For those of you pursuing to buy a camera in the future, make sure that it has the manual mode as well as automatic, and then use the manual mode. The PhD light meter, meaning push here dummy, simply knows nothing about action in the scene, whether to freeze or let it blur. It knows nothing about depth of field. All it wants to do is to get the right amount of light onto the negative. But its definition of the right amount is not what you want in most cases. So it's a very tricky situation. The other piece of advice you can see here is always have something red in this. And again, those of you shooting color as opposed to black and white, that's not a facetious comment, having something red in the scene. Too many of us shoot color in very drab ways. Our images are virtually black and white or gray. We also shoot in bright, contrasty light. In these last 4 days, the lovely blue skies have been horrible for photography. Simply because it washes out all that light. You have to get up early or get out late to really do color, or use some techniques of exposure and perspective. Backlighting is my favorite technique. This is also a reminder, by the way, that some of the best nature photography is not in wilderness areas. You can walk around Holden, for example, village here, and simply see a whole series of nature images that are worth photographing. What I'm doing right now in my hometown of Arcata is photographing what everyone else calls weeds. and developing a series of images that I hope will sensitize people to the fact that we don't need to spray, cut, slash, burn these weeds. Backlighting and underexposure. Again, backlighting and slightly underexposing so that you get with color slides something that's called color saturation. And let's go through slides really quickly. If you overexpose a color slide, what color does it turn it? White or dark?
Dark.
Overexposure with slides will turn white. Underexposure with slides turns it dark and black if you have nothing. So if you want light pastels, overexpose. If you want bright saturated color, underexpose with slides. You can also do it with nature or any other time, lots of trick photography. I personally love to play with it, but it's not worth much. This is a zoom and multiple exposure of this moon set, which is a hint, by the way, the next full moon will be what, around the end of the month. But if you don't like to watch the, if you miss the moon rise, get up early the next few mornings and you can watch the moon set. And by the way, isn't this the equinox coming up?
Okay.
That's kind of a special moment in our lives too. Polarizing filters also supply a cure for this problem, that is that the sky tends to be overexposed simply because our films, print or slide, tend to be oversensitive to blue. So a polarizing filter is the cure. Unless the polarizing filter is too small and then it provides that little vignetting in the corners, which is a flaw. Is everybody clear on that? What a polarizing filter will do is darken the blues, working best at 90 degrees. If the slide projector is the sun, the best effect of a polarizing filter is at 90 degrees to that sunlight.
So the former picture did not have a...
No, yes.
And this does.
And this does. It separates the... it cuts the exposure down in the blue so that blue actually looks blue as opposed to the washed out white. It's a device worth purchasing, a polarizing filter. Also, because so many of your photographs in the shade, in the forest, or in the wintertime will look blue. But let's imagine a green nature trail down here, especially after rain, when it's shining, and a polarizing filter will knock all that blue reflected light out and will make it look more green as opposed to unnatural blue.
That Hanscoat film was... I guess it's not made anymore, but it made it brought out blues.
Yeah, ektachrome is overly blue too in general for most people's taste, but it's a personal choice. Polarizing filters will also convert a regular blue sky to this deep, what, magenta, Hillary?
That's kind of
royal blue. It isn't really that color, but an over-polarized sky will look that color. This is Yosemite. There's some ethics in nature photography too. There's a very distasteful experience in nature photography, and that is to walk along, look down and see either tripod marks or obviously photographer's litter, or I don't care about the tripod marks, but what I care about is that someone has ripped out flowers, rearranged flowers, clipped living plants, moved uprooted things. And that to me is an ethical violation of a photographer's code. People also harass animals or reptiles in a way that I think is a very unethical practice, and in the national parks they're almost to the point of outlawing photography in some areas. Can you imagine getting a citation just breaking your camera out? Well, it can happen, I think, in certain places in the next few years very easily. I also have some ethical conflicts with selling images to certain types of products, and I just use this as a hypothetical case. I mean, it's a real case, but we all eventually need to make some ethical choices about how we use our images. By the way, it's a great example, isn't it, of clear-cut versus old growth? And a composition image. Notice the rule of thirds idea with the train in the third position, a point of power, but also violating that other composition rule where when you have direction, make sure it always goes into the scene. In this case, it's heading out. Light, that was everything. And as I said, I'm starting to complain about our blue sky up here, Scott. Maybe we... what's the weather forecast? Let's get some of God's filtration up there to block all this and scatter the light. And when you have flatter light, you get marvelous color. You don't have to worry about the problem of overexposure. This is also a classic rule of thirds composition. And, by the way, a vertical. Those of you who have never been here, one of my first rules of thumb is your camera works perfectly fine, turn 90 degrees so you get a vertical shot. And many compositions are much better that way. When in doubt, shoot both, horizontal and vertical. Notice the Red Sox. This illustrates a couple of things to all of you. First of all, notice the young man on the lower right shooting at eye level. Again, most of you probably have spent all of your photographic life shooting horizontals and at eye level and wondering, why doesn't this have more snap? Why isn't there more impact in my images? And what we try to do in all of our photo workshops is to get people down, get people on tripods, get people up, get people away from eye level. You also need a camera that has an automatic sign that pops up when you're doing something wrong. It says, wrong way, right? Isn't that a Pentax, I think, that does that? I'm not sure. But in contrast with this moment, flat light on everything, I stood and waited a few minutes. In exactly the same scene, a few steps over to get rid of that highway sign, and waited for the light. And of course it was a fleeting moment, and that's ultimately what nature photography is all about. Being somehow there, ready to take the photograph, to control the technical elements, but also I find the greatest struggle is to be ready to control myself, to control my frustration with the lens cap, to control my, in some cases, hunger or thirst, to control the mosquitoes. But I'm trying to capture a scene ultimately in a way that has some impact. We'll quickly move then on to composition.
Thanks for watching.
And I always throw a couple of joke scenes in here that have been used in text over the years. Most people fail to look through their viewfinder, frankly. And I suffer again. Remember I talking about controlling yourself? You have to slow down when you take photographs. You have to look through the viewfinder. What am I actually seeing here? And you have to look at the edges of the photograph to see what's sticking into the scene. Your eye goes to the brightest object in the scene, and that may not be what you're trying to photograph. In this case, depth of field provided a very cluttered background. Either that or he was born that way, I'm not sure. Another illustration, portraiture. How many of you have gone out and snapped eye-level portraits of your friend? Only later to discover a tree growing out of their head. Or this black horizon line cutting through what was intended to be this marvelous portrait. lots of solutions, and hopefully we'll just illustrate one. Stand high above. By the way, that forces people to open their eyes. If you're down below people, they have a tendency to cut their eyelids down. Also, if you're in a bright, sunny, contrasty weather like we've had, turn people around. You to have their back to the sun and use a backlit portrait. Okay, and again, I'll repeat the standard line here. You know, the haircut's bad, the fly is open, what else? A few other things, personal things. But the photograph is pretty bad, simply because of that bright, washed out sun into the face, deep shadows under the glasses, nose, chin, etc. That stick is kind of poking into my rear in the back. The feet are cut off. There's lots and lots. Simply the turn around, even in this bright light and exposed for the shadow detail. Let the highlights overexpose around you. And then perhaps, certainly zip up the fly before you do anything else. This is poison oak. Yeah. And it's an attractive photo. It's centered, which is something we don't necessarily always want to do. But it illustrates something that handheld photography also leads to. Notice the lack of sharpness as the plant goes down. That's called, well, the issue is depth of field or zone of acceptable sharpness. And by the way, underexposing, of course, slightly, or bracketing as we call it, over what the light meter tells you will enhance the red, bringing out the color saturation. Put that on a tripod and get up to f11, f8, f16, somewhere in there, and you will have much more depth of field. And ultimately an image that you could sell in a variety of markets. And that's my bias, by the way. This is a very expensive hobby, and for me it's a separate avocation as well as vocation. I try to sell my work. And again, light meter, PhD problems, right? Backlit, but what did the light meter do? It averaged all that bright Colorado Grand Canyon country in and said, take this exposure, leaving everything too dark. If you have a fill flash, you could bounce in there and cure that, or you could move in and meter off the shadow area and then back up and compose. Bracketing, this is slightly under but close for the whites, and then bracket, open up, overexpose, get more pastel colors, but of course what happens to the whites then? They start to wash out, you lose the detail. And overexposing slightly for the shadow detail, as I said earlier, remember the umbrella shot? Well, this is the equivalent. The meter would tell me that this is about a half to a full stop overexposed because of those bright flowers right there. But you have to overexpose the scene in order to see the faces under that kind of bright light. Do you ever have any questions, by the way? Anybody?
If you hadn't overexposed, the faces would have been as dark as that couple that we saw under the umbrella on the Colorado.
Easily.
Okay, thank you.
And a couple of issues here. The basic problem is our film has a limited capacity to capture bright to dark. It's called latitude. And in most cases, it's only two or three stops from bright to dark. The rest of it ends up overexposed. See the flowers there? They're way overexposed. Too dark. And the person's shirt on the right is pretty dark. You're losing detail there. So you just have a limited range of scenery that you can capture. That's why flat light is so much nicer. You don't have to worry about such a range of bright to dark. Your shutter speed then provides you with an aesthetic choice, and this is slightly underexposed, by the way. It's too dark for my taste, but it illustrates about a half second or a 1 second exposure, and the marvelous fun it is to change flowing water from crisp droplets flying across to this blur. Of course, the reason I'm doing it in this case is to maximize the depth of field front to back, but also just an aesthetic factor. I wanted to make this water turn into this kind of foamy line of blur, not individual drops. Though the further back you get, the more drops you can see, simply because that's a phenomenon of the further away you are, the more likely you are to freeze the action. Similarly, in this shot, the water in the background is flowing behind these flowers, and with a long shutter speed, it allows you to have a blurred background. You also have to be, of course, in a very quiet moment. The photographers who use 4x5 cameras typically have exposures ranging from 2 to 4 seconds to 20, 30, 60 seconds. And they really need no wind and lots of patience. This friend of mine, Larry Ulrich, or Jeff Ganass, another friend, have both described situations where they sat all day long waiting for the wind to die and ended up only getting one photograph because it was just too windy. But it was a special moment in terms of combination of elements. Shutter speed can also freeze action, and that's a very important aesthetic choice. And most importantly, if you're doing handheld photography, you need to freeze your own heartbeat that's being transmitted into the camera. You need to freeze the vibration from the diaphragm that's pumping air, and you need to freeze that adrenaline that's pumping through your body. The rule of thumb is you need to use one over the focal length of your lens, which is, if you've got a 50 millimeter lens, that means you have to use at least 1/60th of a second. If you have a longer lens, like a 200, you'd have to use 1/250. Most of the inadequacy of your images handheld come from the fact that you're simply shaking the camera when you take the picture. Notice, by the way, the backlighting and the problem of freezing action when it's close to you, even at a fast shutter speed, is a serious problem. Also, lens flare will interfere. The other issue then, back to light meters and PhD, if you want white snow with color slides, the light meter will give you what? Gray snow. Because the light meter wants to convert everything to gray. Normal, average, 18% gray. With color slides, you have to overexpose slightly, and with color prints, also ultimately, you would have to overexpose the snow to get white snow. Quickly, we'll move on again. Aesthetic choices, always in composition, but also in terms of depth of field and shutter speed. Cluttered background, slightly slow shutter speed, combining to let the background go blurred, and also slightly blur this plant, trying to develop an emotional impact. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with depth of field, here comes three sets of images that illustrate it. This would be approximately F4, which is a large f-stop opening, right? And a fast shutter speed to compensate for the big opening, and minimal depth of field. Same scene, probably F16 at about a second or a half a second. Maximum depth of field. but with a telephoto lens, which is another issue. Similar scene, not very well composed, but I shot it simply because those four flowers were at different distances, and only one of them is pretty much in focus. Minimal depth of field, you know, F2. Try to maximize the depth of the field with F22, perhaps F32. Ansel Adams and a group of other folks back in the 30s belonged to a club called F64 because they hated that fuzzy, non-sharp pictorialism that was being put onto society at the time in photography. They said, let's get some reality in the scene. Let's get enough depth of field. And of course, F64 is a very tiny opening. And lots of depth of field. Again, a shift in depth of field coming. By the way, you can also see the subdued light and the ability. You can capture the dark greens and the whites, some detail in the whites. Lots of depth of field. So in this case, what does lots of depth of field do? Clutter in the back. Not as attractive. And a rule of thirds idea, by the way. The flower up in that PowerPoint of the rule of thirds. I put in this as an example because in the background it's just a horrible cluttery mess. But with no depth of field or very little depth of field, you can literally wipe out backgrounds, turn them into that softness. Composition, and then we're wrapping up these slides for tonight. Composition is point of view. Composition is your controlling what goes into the scene. In this case, an aerial photograph of, by the way, this is what South Carolina used to look like, right? Before the hurricane. Composition is looking at a scene and saying, yeah, that's nice, that's normal, that's standard. Let's do something different. Same scene, reverse angle. Silhouettes. Composition is saying horizontal shot, slightly wide angle, on a slick rock day in Zion National Park. And then switching to the very center image in a vertical using a telephoto lens. Someone asked me in the class the other day, I said, but why? I like the first shot. And I said, that's true. I mean, everyone has individual tastes. And ultimately, from my point of view, I cannot predict what an editor is going to prefer for a calendar shot or for a magazine. But I do know that many calendar shots run vertical. I also know that almost every cover of a magazine is vertical. So what I do in most cases is burn up some more film and shoot both, if they have that potential. If they don't, of course, you compose the scene as you choose. This is not my shot. And of course, the classic story is if you want to shoot reptiles, you need to cool them down, either in the ice chest or a refrigerator. And I always like to joke that that's what you do with children, too, if you want to avoid having problems. Cool them down. This is to illustrate two things about composition. The diagonal line, of course, is a classic tool in photography, and also, again, the rule of thirds. If you divide horizontally and vertically in thirds, those lines intersect, creating points of power, which have been used in composition by painters for centuries, and of course now by photographers. Not my image. But at least there's a red shirt, right? A rule of thirds. And a moment. There's a moment here. There's a tension when you do put people in a scene with some action. I always wonder, well, did he get wet or didn't he? Or did he get the kiss or didn't he? And things like that. Or did she get the kiss? did she give when? But it's the classic moment, of course, with the telephoto, eliminating the depth of field problem of the background by reducing it to the... But again, composition in terms of rule of thirds, trying to then, with depth of field, provide an aspen glow in the background that wouldn't be distracting. Same issue here. Again, if you were to look at some many, many of your images, too many of them will have the horizon line smack dab in the middle. It, for some reason, is a psychological phenomenon that we find scenes more pleasing that aren't centered, that aren't cut in half. So practice, either with film, or just with the camera, or just looking at how you might compose a scene using your eye, or sketching, compare centered or having scenes with this rule of thirds idea. Of course, cropping also allows you eventually to turn even our 3x5 aspect into a tighter ratio, as this magazine photograph did, cropping it, making it look more horizontal. And using a telephoto lens, flattening that scene out to make it appear steeper, and the rule of thirds issue. Again, many people center images of flowers. It's just a simple memory device to think about, oh yes, rule of thirds. Let's move the photos out of the center and over. However, to get the color of the flowers correct, you need to meter off the flowers and you need to slightly underexpose them with slide. Rule of thirds. It's a backlight. Rule of thirds again in silhouetting. It's a simple technique for improving your images. Foreground to background as perspective. Photographs are also just flat, two-dimensional objects until the eye can travel into the scene. And unless you provide some kind of front-to-backness, what you're really doing is just a two-dimensional flat, and ultimately a fairly non-active scene. No impact. Your brain doesn't react very positively to that kind of scene. However, if your brain can react with depth, you're going to have a more active situation. Nature also provides some natural tools for depth, and that is looking at lines. There are curved lines. This is the inside of a hot air balloon, not mine. I wish I'd shot that. Rule of thirds composition. Diagonal lines. Vertical lines. With a telephoto, of course, you get this compression of front to back. You have lines that literally carry you off into this, the back of the scene. Those of you who paint know the power of lines and how, again, a painting is transformed from this two dimensions of white paper or canvas into something that you can literally travel into. Lines, diagonals. That, by the way, was severely underexposed. Again, look in nature. Nature provides all we need for our compositions if we simplify the scene. And again, if we attempt to allow the eye to focus on things. And one of the tools for doing that is to put an object like this plant against the darkness rather than having it muddled by against the light areas as well. You need to single things out to allow the eye to focus quickly. I think we're nearing our end. This is snowfall in the redwoods, which occurs about once every 5 years at home. We get 200 inches of snow every millennia, I think, down in the redwoods. Unlike your once a year. The problems with the redwoods and in general many instances of any kind of trees with wide angle lenses, you get some tilting, and that results simply from the fact that wide angle lenses distort. Redwoods are very, very difficult to photograph, frankly. Make them look like redwoods. Instead, they start to tilt. In this case, though, I guess one's eye is caught more by the snowfall.
What angle
was
that?
That was a 35. If you go to a 28 or a 24, you get enormous keystoning, tilting beneath that. See, here again, you can see the result, but a vertical has, in this case, a little less impact. The center tree, which is straight up and down, also helps a little bit. By the way, off on the right there, you have the result of someone not slowing down. I failed to look at that little branch cluttering up the scene. And that happens all the time. On our field trip tomorrow, what I'll be talking about and demonstrating with the tripod or handheld, it's just the idea to slow down, avoid snap shooting, avoid eye level work, and concentrating on looking at what's in that viewfinder. The next thing that we'll be demonstrating is most simple. Think about taking your photograph. And by the way, in most cases, what you next need to do is to take another step forward and focus again to make it tighter. Too many images are too loose around the edges. But I love this photograph. Early dawn light, frost, freezing, in fact. And I love this photograph. And I took two shots of it, and I said, there's another photograph here. What is it? And for me, the photograph that I always inevitably like better is the tighter photograph, a simpler photograph. You move in. And you can do that with a zoom lens very easily, by the way. I encourage that. Or you simply have to keep moving physically closer to the scene if you can. And isolating objects against dark background is just a solution to focusing the viewer or creating more impact. Front light on Columbine, in retrospect, it's two images there is too competing for me. I personally don't like that anymore. Or lying on the ground under the flower, in this case handheld, and looking up at the backlit columbine and the backlit bud there. It's actually kind of cluttered having both right there. But the point is not the image, the point is the technique. You need to change perspective, and of course backlighting is a marvelous technique.
Did you underscore that?
Yes. Good question. You need to underexpose that or you would get a white flower and it would be burned out. There would be no detail in it. Also, you would see detail in the diagonal off in the right, and that white silvery edge would be washed out. And so by underexposing or bracketing, as we call it, you just keep experimenting and you see what you get when you get the work back later.
When you say underexpose, how many stops do you
Well, I always underexpose a half stop from what my light meter tells me for color saturation. And then in this case, two things are happening. One is there's a black background, right? And the light meter wants to do what with that black background? Wants to average it out to gray along with the white converting it to gray. So I know right away that the light meter is going to make it an overexposed scene. So in this case, I went to one full stop under and then two full stops under, which this is.
What was the background?
It was a shade of a rock. It looks, and it was in the middle of the Wind River Range, Wyoming. It's got great columbine. Same situation here, which we could do anywhere. I was on the wrong side of the mine this morning, but I think this is what I'm going to attempt tomorrow morning with some of those, that mine scene up there, is get on the west side of it and shoot back into the dawn and underexpose and get those timbers, all girders, all silhouetted against the sunrise. This is easily 1.5 or 2, maybe even, well, 2 stops I know for sure, under what the light meter said, because it was averaging that bright sky. Again, in this particular situation, you're metering off the brightest area of the sunset, but what's the light meter also capturing and trying to average? Those rocks. And so if you truly want good saturated sunsets, you need to, with color slides, you need to underexpose that. And in this case, a full stop to get the rocks to turn into a pure silhouette. I mentioned earlier, the same evening, I shot 2 full rolls of film waiting, attempting to get a lightning bolt, but somehow light travels faster than my finger when you hold it open. Texture, another composition device, and then we'll be wrapped up here. Ponderosa pine, a telephoto shot of a sand dune behind these flamingos, and those are footprints across the sand in the background. So we have an unreal, surreal image actually resulting from this combination. But impact? Yes, it has impact. Texture. And again, a humorous shot. I love this guy's neck.
It looks just like the
elephant. Yeah, exactly. That's the point. The juxtaposition is, of course, a composition tool as well. And then this marvelous black and white image. It has multiple messages. First of all, the texture is so fantastic. The old face and the young, untouched face. But from a symbolic standpoint of those of you who know the Navajo and the Hopi reservations and so on, the face is looking in opposite directions. I mean, it's just such a powerful symbol of what's happening. And then black and white, by the way, which I'm getting back into again, I love it. See up in here, that dark, dark area? That extra darkness is caused by a technique of burning in. You add more light just to that area and in the top center to get rid of distractions. It's a manipulation. All of Ansel Adams' work is manipulated. None of his images in black and white reflect the way the scene actually looked. He filtered the scene in the camera and in the darkroom. Black and white is a powerfully manipulated medium, if you choose to do it. And it's an exceptional rendition of nature or people. But again, just nature, you can capture, in this case, the old yucca plant leaves, flat light, lots of depth of field. People, and this is the last, people, portraits of people. A logger from Humboldt County, backlit, pensive moment, and indeed, the end of the old growth is upon the industry. Flat light, not this bright, harsh light, rule of thirds, exposed for the brightest area. Notice how the uniform, this is an underexposed color slide, the uniform is disappearing, except for the red star and the lighter areas, and because the subject is the metered area, not the uniform. And lastly, the last image here, break all of these composition rules. Again, a shot from National Geographic that I think typifies. Don't center the scene. Don't shoot in harsh light. Don't have distracting things around the focal point of the image. Let's see, what other rules can we talk about here? Don't cut the scene in half.
Eye level.
Eye level. Thanks.